I tried again, my second full draft from ground zero with a completely different approach, and once again, it was better, it was closer, but it wasn't there. It wasn't until, on a completely related project, and I'll probably talk about it more on the audiobook version of that book, a book called Ender's Shadow, which was something, believe me, I never planned to write. But for various reasons, I found myself writing a novel that was exactly parallel to Ender's Game, only it focused on the character of Bean. It saw all of the same events through Bean's eyes. And as soon as that book existed, though I didn't see it at first, the key to Ender's Game the movie had now been found. It took the interest of Richard LeGravenez in working on Ender's Game. He thought that the book was terrific. He wanted to be involved. He's a great screenwriter. But it was his wife, Anne, who first said, no, you don't adapt Ender's Game. You adapt Ender's Game and Ender's Shadow. And she was dead on. As soon as I heard that from her, I realized that she had found that key. My novel, Ender's Shadow, was the way to make Ender's Game, not by filming Ender's Shadow, because that's not Ender's story, that's Bean's story, but by focusing on the relationship between Ender and Bean, we solved the fundamental movie-making problem with Ender's Game. And here's what the problem was. Ender's Game takes place inside Ender's head. The only way you understand the horrible moral dilemmas that he's facing, the only reason you care deeply about him, the only reason that you're so emotionally involved, is that you're inside his head throughout the entire novel. And movies can't do that. Movies can't tell you what the character is thinking. I mean, they can. They can give you voiceovers, for example. So Ender's walking along a corridor in battle school, and suddenly you hear his voice. He's not speaking, but you know you're getting his thoughts. And he says, I wonder what Peter's doing right now. What a dreadful way to handle Ender's thoughts. It wouldn't work. Or you have the character talk about his thoughts and feelings, which is the standard thing you do in movies. But with Ender's Game, Ender is a quiet guy. He doesn't reveal his feelings. If he does, he's not Ender. So there's no way to tell you what he's feeling. But as soon as you bring Bean into the story as an equal or nearly equal character, now you have what Hollywood is good at, a buddy movie. You have two characters who are at first antagonistic, then later become allies in a struggle against adults. The adults are trying to decide which of them is going to be the commander that they need in order to save the world, so that even when they're cooperating, the adults are still seeing a competition between them. And right up to the last minute, it's there in Ender's Game, it's explicit in Ender's Shadow, we don't know which of them is going to be in command at the final battle. Now that's the story Hollywood could tell. And not only that, we could tell it more briefly. My first script that included both Ender's Game and Ender's Shadow was 20 pages shorter than any script I had ever written from Ender's Game alone. It was doable. And my script proved that it could be done because that script had the emotional impact. Now, you know, no studio can ever justify spending $120 million to make a movie based on a script written by the author who has never had a movie made before. So they have other writers coming in, and I'm sure that the draft I wrote is not even going to be close to what the final draft is. Nevertheless, I proved that the emotional impact could be there and that the problems could be solved. And I was happy. I'm perfectly willing to let them go ahead. Well, based on that that take on the adaptation, Warner Brothers got involved, with Wolfgang Peterson attached to direct, and we'll see if this packaging ends up being the one that goes onto the screen. If it does, that'll be great. The irony, though, is that everybody who read Ender's Game immediately started saying, oh, that book is so good, it ought to be a movie. Think about it for a minute. It's already a book. You know, Shakespeare stuff was great before it was a movie. Dickens's novels were great before they were made into a movie. But in America today, film is the premier art form. Anything that we think is wonderful, we want to turn into a movie so that it can be made perfect, because that's what we view as the epitome, the acme of art, of the storytelling art. And I accept that. I'm an American. You know, I want to see these things filmed. I wanted to see the Harry Potter movie and was delighted when finally with the third Harry Potter movie, they got it right. We want to see movies made from books. But the fact of the matter is, film is not the ideal setting for a book by Orson Scott Card. And that's because my background is in theater. And when I'm writing books, I'm not really writing prose. What I'm doing is I'm improvising a performance, an oral performance. My narration is meant to be read aloud. I'm never happier than when people tell me, oh, when I was reading the Alvin Maker books or when I read Ender's Game, my wife and I read it aloud to each other, or my dad read this book to us at bedtime as when I was a kid, or my teacher read Ender's Game to us in our classes. That's what I want to hear, because my stuff needs to be read aloud. And that's why for me, I hope the film is wonderful. I'll make a lot of money if it is. But for me, the ideal presentation of any book of mine is to have excellent actors perform it in an audio-only format. And that's what you have right here. That's what you just listened to. I've had a lot of productions over the years, audio productions of my books. Back in the days of abridgment, it didn't work as well because my stories don't abridge well. I brought a lot of habits from my playwriting days to my fiction writing. And when I was a playwright, I was a bare stage playwright. I didn't believe in realistic sets. I didn't want them. I wanted all my plays performed on Shakespeare's stage. I wanted it so that you knew what setting you were in because of the words that were said and the dialogue between the actors. If I wanted you to think you were in the Forest of Arden, then like Shakespeare, I would say, well, here we are in the Forest of Arden. But unless it was essential to the story, you would never see anything. So I don't describe. You know, I've had people say, I hated the graphic descriptions of violence in your book. Well, I will challenge them. Where? What graphic description? And they can't find it. And I say, well, then guess where the graphic description of the violence came from? Came from your head. You imagined it. Well, of course, I wanted them to imagine it, and I really am still responsible to a degree for what they see in their minds when they read my books. But there's no description. There are no incidents that are there as filler. There's no fluff. There's no empty dialogue. I try to write with the discipline of a playwright so that if there's dialogue, it's because the words that are said are essential to understand the forward movement of the story or to understand the characters. So my books do not abridge well. Even so, I was still delighted to have my books coming out in audio, even in abridged format. There was one in particular, one abridged production of my novel Lost Boys, read by Robbie Benson. He did a splendid job, and even though enormous swaths of the book, whole characters, were cut out in order to make the abridgment, I felt like the story worked. But I have to say, I'm delighted that finally my books are coming out regularly in unabridged format, with excellent productions. And I have to give credit to the man who was the main reader of this book, Stefan Rudnitsky, who is not just the reader, he's also the producer, the director. When he looks at these books, he doesn't look at them as just having some guy come in and read them. He looks at the theatrical potential. He's somebody who understands oral storytelling. He casts the voices splendidly, with the one exception that he allowed me to make my vanity cameo. Just see if you can guess which voice in this production that you just heard was mine, because I'm in it. Anyway, he does a great job on this and many other productions, whether he's the reader or merely the director and producer, of putting out the kind of production that I want my books to have. So when the movie comes out, when it's finally made, I hope you'll go see it. I hope it makes billions of dollars all around the world and allows me to have the power in Hollywood to get more of my projects made. But in the meantime, you already have what I think of as the ideal presentation of my novel Ender's Game, which is the audiobook that you have just heard.
We hope you've enjoyed Ender's Game, an audio renaissance audiobook from Tor Forge. This program was produced by Stefan Rudnicki and remastered by Tim Franklin. Text copyright 1977, 1985, and 1981 by Orson Scott Card. Production copyright 2002 and 2004 by Audio Renaissance, a division of Holtzbrinck Publishers, LLC. All rights reserved.